Welcome to Worlds Apart. In the years since the Ukrainian conflict entered its kinetic stage, international relations have changed more than in the decades prior to it. And the most surprising shifts occurred among countries not directly involved in this war. In deciding what stance to take, they had to carefully weigh their interests and resources against longer geopolitical and geoeconomic trends, and almost all came up with their own version of neutrality. Is neutrality becoming a byword for sovereignty? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Pascal Letat, Associate Professor for Neutrality Studies at Kyoto University. Professor Letat, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I have to say that I'm a big fan of your YouTube channel. I think it's a very rare source of genuine analysis, which is such a rarity these days. And I want to start by asking about this, because political science is called science because at least initially there was a presumption that it's done for the sake of finding objective trends and basing policy solutions in actual rather than preferred or concocted reality. When did it change? When did it become so divorced from what is actually happening on the ground?
Well, it never really did. It was a misnomer from the start. Political science is considered part of social sciences, and social sciences is fundamentally misnamed. It's a stupid name to begin with. Natural sciences are real sciences because they're able to create hypotheses and then test them through experiments. Now, social scientists, at some point, the people who do politics and so on, got very envious of the certainty that these people in the natural sciences are able to create. So what they did is they try to borrow these methods, use them in their own analysis, which has its, I mean, that's fair and square, that's okay. But one thing social sciences can never do, never, is experiments. We cannot run history again. We cannot go back and look at what would have happened had Hitler been killed or something like that. We cannot run the experiments. So we are living with this flaw. And all the political sciences and international relations especially, hence, has a propensity towards bias. So we interpret things. So it would be way more honest to call it a social philosophy. And within that, we have methods to come to conclusions. But especially
Professor
international
Letat,
relations
with all the limitations, I think your point is well taken. But I think throughout the whole history of diplomacy and international relations, there was an understanding that, first of all, there are certain trends according to which countries and an international system develops. And second, it was considered necessary to understand your enemy's imperatives and red lines. It was considered part, you know, a way of doing due diligence because, you know, it allowed countries to minimize their own policy costs. It allowed to minimize unnecessary escalation. And I think you made a point in one of your articles that, for example, in the case of Ukraine and Russia's security sensibilities in that region, that was deliberately ignored. I wonder why. Was it a sort of ignorance out of ignorance, or was it a deliberate stance?
I don't know. So this is one of my big questions. We see two things when we look at the past. On the one hand, we have wars of choice that countries wanted to fight because they had some strategic objectives. And I see elements of that in the current situation when we basically have a proxy war. Ukraine is a proxy war for the much larger war between NATO and Russia that's going on. And we have forces on both sides which would like to fight that. But on the other hand, we also have moments in history when we see how ideology eats brain. Right. The ideology takes over. The Crusades were a dumb idea. The whole 30 Years' War in Europe was a really horribly dumb idea when people kill each other for ideological reasons. And what we are seeing at the moment, at least in the West, because I perceive Russia and China as inherently realist, but in the West, we are seeing this dominance of an ideology that portrays the world in a very certain way. And if you follow that logic within the ideological
way,
camp.
Very flattering way.
Very self-serving.
That is not really accorded with the actual history, at least the way it was recorded.
No, so I don't know whether the people in power in the West actually believe some of the stupidities they utter because they're unable to actually compare with their own actions, or if they actually know that they're faking it and but use that in order to fight a war that they want to fight with Russia, because this war in Ukraine was utterly preventable. Every realist in the West, from Noam Chomsky to Henry Kissinger, everyone said this plot of land has to be neutral. It's a no-brainer. Everybody understood it, and still we have this war, which leads me to the question, are these people ideologically driven, or is there just the faction that wanted it having it? And we are the propagandized masses at the moment, all over the place, in Russia and in the West.
You wrote before, and you just said it now, that the war in Ukraine could have been avoided if the West and Ukraine hadn't misinterpreted Russia's demands for security guarantees. And I remember when those security guarantees were put on the table and openly discussed back in 2021, especially during the last in-person meeting between Biden and Putin in Geneva, Russia had a sizable contingent on Ukraine's border, at least 80,000 troops. And that strikes me as a pretty direct expression of intent. You know, like, there's not much room for misinterpretation here. Why do you think the West didn't take the Russian signal the way it was sent, at least?
So it was a huge mistake in December 2021 not to come to an agreement with Russia. These treaties that Russia sent to NATO and to Washington didn't mention the word neutrality, but it's exactly what they demanded. And my interpretation was they didn't put the word in there in order not to forsake the fate.
Sorry for interrupting, but I think it would be a crucial note to make, considering your field study. Russia didn't ask for neutrality, but neutrality at that point of time was a means of protecting status quo. It wasn't about expansion of Russia's interest. It was simply preserving peace and status quo.
Yes. Look, the tragedy of Ukraine is that for the entire time that Ukraine had a neutrality clause in its constitution up until 2014, as long as this was credible, there was no problem. And as soon as it looked as if the Ukraine could actually eventually become a NATO member, that's the moment when Crimea happened in 2014. Then the clause went away, and then everything went sour and south from there. So that was bad. And your initial question, why the West didn't take it serious? I didn't believe Russia would invade because, in my view, this is so hurtful to Russia, because these people in Ukraine are your brothers and sisters, and this is a civil war, basically a late civil war. So I didn't believe it wouldn't happen. And Mr. Putin and like the Russian leadership continuously said, we are not intending to fight a war. That's why I interpreted the troops as a way of saber rattling without wanting to do it, because I believed the speech that was coming.
This is such an important point, I think, that is totally missed in the West, that for Russia, it's a very, very difficult war, not only in terms of material supplies or, you know, financial pressure, but for ethical and brotherly, reasons. And I agree with you that nobody thought that Russia would initiate that operation. But, you know, sometimes I think if the West actually counted on the fact that Russia can push into the corner precisely on that premise, that it would never ever dare to attack the Ukrainians, even if the Ukrainian leadership is totally hijacked and the Ukrainian territory is totally hijacked by the enemy. Don't you think that Putin ultimately, as a commander-in-chief, I'm not asking, by the way, for the endorsement of this policy, but didn't he have to do something to fulfill his duties as the commander-in-chief of Russia?
Well, it is obviously now the conclusion that he took. I just thought the hurt or the fear of like how much it would hurt would actually not allow this to happen. Look, the people who understood Russia very well in the past, George Kennan and one of the persons I interviewed first on my channel, Ambassador Jack Matlock, the last U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union right before everything fell apart. These people said, if we push NATO to the borders and if we try to integrate all of these countries, there will be a war. And in the end, they were right. Now, does that Does that justify the Russia's actions? No, it doesn't. Because we do have a fundamental problem, but the fundamental problem is much bigger than Russia, which is that countries, especially great powers, take the right to self-defend in other countries. That is the original sin of international relations ever after the Second World War. For my self-defense, I go and fight abroad. Russia committed that too, but the West has committed that like dozens of times since the end of the Second World War.
So I know you like equating Russia's actions to that of the West, and you even said that Russia is, I think, ruthlessly using the West playbook. But we are not fighting on the other side of the world, you know? Like, we are sending our own soldiers, and we are suffering both in terms of our own economy, in terms of our society. We are making our personal contribution in... first of all, fighting not only for our security, but also for our selfhood. And this is something that I want to ask you about, because I also interview a lot of people from around the world. And I see this upsurge in not just sovereignty, but national selfhoods all around the world, in India, in China, in Latin America, in Africa. And I think this rise, the collective emergence of collective selfhoods, is ultimately at odds with the Western concept of itself, because the West only believes that only its way is legitimate, and all the other countries having their own manifest destiny seem to be, you know, automatically Western enemies. Is this war only for security, or is it for something bigger than that?
Well, it has already influenced international relations tremendously, right? And the way that other countries behave, and the changes that we are seeing with Saudi Arabia, with Iran coming to new accords, and with Russia also like having a new relationship with China and so on. These are tremendous changes. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that this was probably the intent from the beginning. This is certainly an effect, but, you know, especially when wars start and how wars end, they usually go very different from the way that people start to plan them.
Now, I want to ask you specifically about NATO, because, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk whether NATO threatens or doesn't threaten NATO. And you wrote that it's pretty much irrelevant. What's important is the perception of threat. But given the recent statements by European leaders like Angela Merkel, Francois Hollande, that Minsk agreements were never meant to be ceasefire agreements, they were only meant as an opportunity to give Ukraine time to regroup and rearm. Can you really blame Russia for feeling very insecure about NATO's intentions? I mean, the way it's interpreted in Russia right now is that, look, we were not paranoid all along. These people planned to, you know, attack us or to threaten us from the territory of our neighbor.
I agree with you. I mean, you don't need to be a genius to have strategic empathy. Look, at whom are these missiles pointed at? I mean, NATO, the Cold War ceased to be, NATO didn't, and the missiles always pointed to Moscow. That's absolutely clear. And NATO didn't expand to the Atlantic, NATO expanded to the East. And like the also, when you look at the rhetoric that comes from Eastern European countries, which maybe for legitimate reasons are afraid of the Russians, that's possible that they also feel threatened. That's the tragedy of international relations. Everybody feels threatened by everybody, and everybody feels like a victim. And if you feel like a victim, you feel justified to defend yourself, right? So I understand that Russians feel threatened, and they are. I mean, there's all of these publications just 2 days ago in Foreign Policy again. We should prepare for decolonizing Russia, for breaking up Russia in 20 successor states. That's the only humane way of continuing with the entire region. It's like, are you people crazy? And they write that. They do write that. And then they wonder why Russia perceives them as a threat.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I'm sure they're not watching your channel or reading any history books, because there are a number of, you know, Western leaders that attempted to do that in the past, and it never bode well for them. But let's take a very short break right now, and we can come back to this discussion in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
So So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Pascal Lata, Associate Professor for Neutrality Studies at Kyoto University. Professor Lata, just before the break, I cut you short and you had, I'm sure, an interesting point to express.
Well, the point is, like, people in Russia and in Ukraine would, most of them who are old enough, remember that they were living in a completely different country. They were living in the USSR, and then the USSR broke apart into 15 successive states. People who went through that would naturally think that maybe something could happen again. So I really understand that a lot of people in Russia are legitimately afraid of what's going to happen to their country.
Now, Professor Lata, you're teaching in Japan, and I think Japanese history is very crucial for understanding Russia's deep mistrust of Western intentions, because Japan was the only country that was subjected to an attack by nuclear weapons for no apparent tactical reasons. And the way it was interpreted in both the Soviet and the Russian historiography is that it was an act of disproportionate, cruel, blatant intimidation, for the sake of making a geopolitical point. Do you think the current Western and particularly American leadership, with its current political culture, with the fact that they still haven't recognized the bombing of Japan as a historic mistake, do you think they're still capable of doing something like that to make that point?
Yes. Although I must say that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not that huge a point. They were bigger as a point towards the Soviet Union than against Japan, because Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the incineration of these two cities. But during the entire previous month, several cities were incinerated. You know, more people died in the firebomb raids of Tokyo than died during Hiroshima, right? In one single night. So the 1945 was a huge exercise of the United States terrorizing civilian populations illegally. This was clearly illegal. This was a war crime, just the way that Japanese committed war crimes in China, just the way that war crimes have happened in Europe. It was a war crime and it was never persecuted.
But it was because by a totally different kind of weapons. I mean, it's not that there is a big difference for the victims, but, you know, in terms of the effect it produces, a public effect, nuclear weapons is not comparable to anything else.
It was, although, like, since I studied that period, I must say the fact that a nuclear weapon was dropped on Japan was a good excuse for the doves in Tokyo who wanted to surrender to actually surrender. It helped those who wanted to surrender because there was an option of continuing fighting, and we have this problem. So it was a horrible thing, and it shouldn't have happened. But if you're asking me, yes, I think we are capable of doing something stupid like that again, and I hope it won't happen.
Now, let's talk about the international impact of the conflict in Ukraine. And I want to start my question with quoting Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki, who said the other day that Russia's victory in Ukraine would amount to the end of the West's golden age. As if that golden age was supposed to be eternal. Putting aside Russia, do you think other countries, especially non-Western countries, have much sympathy or desire for the West's golden age to continue?
Well, every country has an interest in their own well-being, right? And we've seen now 500 years of European dominance or Anglo-European dominance of the world, basically, right? I mean, we white people, and I include, of course, all of Russia, we basically raped the rest of the world.
Well,
I mean,
we didn't.
Different
Maybe
ways.
You did. We didn't have the colonial
Central
policies.
Asia and so on.
No, but the way Russia expanded itself was absolutely different from the way the West did it. We don't have the white man's burden. I mean, we have a totally different concept of, you know, integrating societies, and it's still pretty visible in Russia these days. The ethnic and national relations, especially during the Soviet times, by the way, the Russians were the least politically endowed national group within the Soviet Union. But anyway, let's put that aside, because I'm struck by this notion of the golden age, because it sounds like extremely racist to me and openly xenophobic, because the golden age for the West, you know, the way international system is structured, meant significant misbalances and much less precious conditions for many other countries. And most of those countries want the international system to be, if not fair, then at least balanced. You know, they want to get their fair share. They want to get their fair due. Do you think, you know, Western pleas for this eternal privilege resonate with them well?
No, and that's why actually South America, Africa, and most of Southeast Asia and Asia in general is not going along and doesn't swallow the Western narrative. I'm not entirely sure how much they believe the Russian narrative neither, but they don't go along. And this kind of like golden age stuff, that's exactly the thing that then outrages people outside of the bubble. And this doesn't help. This doesn't help to create followers, right?
This is actually an interesting point you just made, that you're not sure how much they are buying both the Western and Russian narrative. And this conflict strikes me as one of the first conflicts where narratives don't even matter, because the countries seem to be of their own mind. They are doing their own calculations, you know, and they're looking at their own reality picture in order to decide where to position themselves. Isn't that a new development brought in by this conflict, that the influence of propaganda seems to be diminishing?
Well, the influence of propaganda is strongest inside these bubbles, right? Inside the West, probably inside, I don't know Russia, I haven't been there, but probably there too, and probably like also inside China, you know, the propaganda is targeted towards your own, because if you want to go to war, you really need to motivate people to take up arms and run towards the bullets. So you need to build a very strong argument, and the West is building at the moment a very strong argument to basically hate on Russia and break all the links, including the banning of your network in the whole of Europe. This is mind-boggling to me, you know.
I mean, the classical writers, Dostoevsky and Chekhov, I mean, they have to do with that. But
And expelling Russian sportsmen and sportswomen, you know, all of this is supposed to break the links to the people so that we cannot feel compassion for each other anymore. And this is absolutely horrible. And we need to fight that dynamic. And we need to integrate the Ukrainians. We need to integrate the Russians. We need to build trust again, because that's going to be the basis of any kind of peace that's going to come after this.
Well, if you're truly interested in peace, but do you think that's actually one of the Western intentions? Because I think another distinct feature of this conflict is that, unlike in any others, peace is not even paid lip service. I mean, there are no calls for negotiations. In fact, there are outright calls for continuing this war. Do you think there is any sort of deliberate association between the continuation of this war and the Western political agenda to preserve, you know, what it sees as its strategic interest, which is dominance?
Yeah, look, every country wants peace, but only its peace. The West also wants peace, but only a peace at its own definition. And Russia wants peace at its own definition.
It wants the whole world, come on. And they're pretty explicit about it.
Well, if you got the whole world, you got peace. You see, I mean, that's the whole point. You try to use weapons to bring the peace that you desire. Now, the difficult part is always to accept the peace that is not perfect. And I do think that the way this is going, like over the long run, there will have to be a peace that nobody is happy with.
Now, many countries, as I mentioned in my introduction, now describe their position as neutral, but I find through my line of work that neutrality has different shades to it. And the way the Chinese view neutrality is very different from the way Indian describe it, or the way it's seen in Turkey and South Africa. What does neutrality even mean in this day and age?
It means what countries need it to mean. Neutrality is one of the most flexible concepts in international relations that you can imagine, which is why it's so useful, but why it is so inherently difficult to grasp. So the chances we have is that countries fill it with a meaning that is useful to them and hopefully to others, because at its core, it means I'm not taking the side of either of these completely. I'm not going to have a military alliance, which is why I also think China is not actually in an alliance with Russia. Other scholars also agree here, because you don't have this NATO mechanism and blah, 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 blah. You have a good friendship, yes. And there's various degrees here. And I would hope that more countries claiming neutrality would help to de-escalate the spiral between these two rivals.
Speaking about Russia and China, I think both Moscow and Beijing are not describing their relationship as an alliance. And even though this concept is not very particularly popular in Russia, I think it's more like an open relationship when they have mutual attraction, but they also have practical benefits of sticking together. And the flexibility of this arrangement is viewed as a particular value within the construct of the relationship. How does it compare with Western insistence on alliances and unity? And why do you think the concept of neutrality is ultimately so unpalatable to the West? Because as we discussed, it's the West that is against the concept of neutrality, both for Ukraine and, as we saw, for Finland and Sweden.
See, neutrality is always benefiting the weaker part of a conflict more. You can be neutral, but your neutrality, political neutrality, will never be outcome neutral. It will always benefit one of both parties of a conflict. And right now, in the conflict between Russia and NATO, Russia is the weaker part. So Russia is more interested in neutrality. And the West understands that. That's why they try to crack down on everybody else as hard as they can, because they know that this neutrality will ultimately benefit Russia. It's a very natural dynamic of a triangular relationship. And it's another way of like imposing dominance.
Now, for many countries, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think for many Western countries, neutrality is no longer a security concept. You know, the way they talk about it, it's couched in a very psychological language. It's either you're with us or you're against us. You have to be on the right side of history. And I wonder if you think it will remain that way, especially considering that the United States is increasingly preferring its Pacific allies more than its European ones. I mean, both in terms of economic developments, in terms of military developments. The United States is looking more engagingly towards the Pacific, and Europe is sort of left to fend for itself. Do you think that will empower the strive for neutrality, or do you think that would make it weaken?
I can't predict it, but at the moment in Europe, neutrality is shrinking. We've lost Finland, we've lost Sweden, and the other countries are also very much ideologically captured. But neutrality is thriving in the developing world, South America, Africa, most of Asia. So there will be a change. You know, every international system creates again its own version of neutrality that's then adapted to that situation. I cannot foresee yet what it is, but neutrality is moving out of Europe and moving into the wider world, probably around some form of non-alignment. For Europe, the situation ain't great, really not. I mean, we now have like very hard fronts, and this is very dangerous. So I would hope that in some level, some form of de-escalation, not necessarily neutrality, but de-escalation would come along, because we need to live together. You know, our continent is not good at not slitting each other's throats. We have to stop this, and we keep failing over and over on our common Eurasian continent.
Absolutely, but in order for long peace to take place, you need to leave and let leave, and allow the golden age to affect not only yourself, but also your neighbors far and wide. Professor Latai, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.